This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight I have been joined by two friends and guests who are going to talk about what I've termed the outside looking in. Let me have them go ahead and introduce themselves. First of all, we have Bridget. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, John. Happy to be here tonight.
Thanks. And we have someone who's returning from one of our early episodes, Chris Smith. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Okay, the main reason, besides the fact that you're both brilliant and articulate, that I brought you on, is neither of you are Mormons, nor have you ever been Mormons. So you're both sort of Mormon watchers, I would say, or you engage in the Mormon community. I'm going to start the discussion by first having you sort of introduce yourself and give your kind of background so we know where you're coming from. Why don't we start with you, Bridget? Let us know who you are.
I should talk about my religion first. And I was not raised in a religious household myself. If you had asked my parents, they would have said that they were Protestants, but we never went to church, never read the Bible, had family prayers or anything. So it's very much a non-religious household. I spent the first 10 years of my life up in Alaska with no immediate family living near me. And we were too poor to travel. So I kind of grew up in a bubble that way and didn't get to meet any of my relatives. But when I was 10, I moved down to Washington State, where I was introduced to my aunt, who was an evangelical Christian. She attended what's called the Church of the Nazarene. So she was the first person who preached to me. I became a Christian when I was 10. When I was 16, I started attending a Presbyterian church instead. And now I attend the Evangelical Covenant Church. I'm a student at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I'm working on my master's degree in American Christian History. And I'm very involved with the evangelical community. I've been a worship leader. I've been a missionary. I've been a nursery worker, which is just tons of fun, and a youth leader. So that is me in a nutshell.
Okay, great. Thanks. And Chris, how about you?
Well, I was raised a Pentecostal, which is sort of evangelical with a radical twist. We used to do youth worship services with black lights and a fog machine and rock and roll music. Kind of give you an idea of the background that I came from. And then went to college to get a biblical studies degree and ended up kind of deciding that that evangelicalism wasn't the absolute true faith that I had believed it was. And so now I consider myself a Christian pluralist, which means that I do consider myself a Christian. I follow the teachings of Jesus, but I also don't believe that Christianity is the single or the necessarily the best way to be religious.
Okay, great. Thanks. All right. So, I think we want to start the discussion. Obviously, since neither of you are members of the church, nor have you ever been members of the church, I guess we want to find out why you care about the church and sort of how you got tangled up with it. Chris, why don't you go ahead and lead us out on this one?
Okay. Well, I dated the bishop's daughter. And so we kind of church swapped, and I went to her church and she came to my church, and I read a book by Leonard J. Arrington called The Mormon Experience, and the first chapter was full of stuff about Joseph Smith and his seer stones, and it was really kind of a fascinating introduction to Mormonism. It's supposed to be apologetic, but it came across for me as someone who had never even heard of these things before. It came across as very almost devastating to Mormonism. So I thought, well, this is the official historian of the LDS Church writing this. I can't imagine what I could find on the internet. So I kind of looked at the anti-Mormon websites for a while, then moved to the apologetic websites, and then started bidding on the discussion boards. And I guess it's really the community that's drawn me in, I think. I've just made so many friends, and Mormons and ex-Mormons, and liberal Mormons, the whole gamut. And I've just gotten so involved in it that I can't imagine extricating myself from it at this point.
Now, when you say the community, is that mostly like the online community, or do you actually associate with Mormons who live around you?
It's the online community, but I also go to like the Sunstone Symposium. In fact, I took one of those online quizzes that said, "What kind of Mormon are you?" And I said I was a Sunstone Mormon. And I thought that was very apt because I have a lot of friends at Sunstone. And
I got Mormon intellectual on that quiz.
Oh, did you? Well, that's what I look forward to every year is the Sunstone. And I also go to Claremont Graduate University where I'm doing the Mormon Studies program. And so I've got lots of Mormon friends and associates here too. So
a degree in Mormon studies. Are you the only one who is a non-member in the program? I know the program exists, but I don't know what the dynamics of it actually are.
It won't actually be a degree in Mormon studies. It'll be a degree in history of religions in North America.
Okay.
So there are other non-Mormons in the program who take the Mormon classes, but the Mormon studies is sort of. I mean, they have a Mormon studies chair, that's Richard Bushman, and then he teaches numerous Mormon studies classes.
Wow. So that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun.
Okay, Bridget, for you, how did you get plugged in?
Well, Chris and I have at least something in common in that it was a member of the opposite sex that pulled us in. But by the way, Chris, how old were you when this started?
It was, sophomore year of high school.
Okay, just curious. I was just starting my junior year of high school. And my parents finally, this was 1998, I think, and my parents finally got a computer with the interweb. So I began chatting with people in Yahoo chat rooms, and I ran into a guy there who was a freshman at BYU. He was 18, I was 16, and he was Mormon. And this is really, really pathetic, but we kind of had one of those failed online relationships where, I'd log in and talk to him every day. Eventually he began calling me on the phone. We would talk on the phone often, but he began trying to get me to learn about his religion. Now, my initial reaction to that was, do not want. I was incredibly confused because he would affirm to me that Mormons are Christians. He would assure me that he regarded me as a Christian. And in my mind, Christianity was it. There was no such thing as more Christian and less Christian or true Christian and not quite true Christian. You were either Christian or you weren't. So very confusing to me that he thought I was Christian, but he thought I needed to join his church. The Presbyterians hadn't tried to make me join their church. The Nazarenes hadn't tried to, they didn't really care if I switched churches. So it was very strange to me to meet someone from a church that wanted me to switch to his church. I began hanging out with the LDS kids at high school. They talked me into taking the missionary discussions. Simultaneously, I made the internet my new best friend and began searching for any information I could get on Mormonism, which kind of led me to, I guess you would call them the anti-Mormon sites, so I'm not trying to be pejorative and calling them that. They were, the sites that were critical of the church, though. And I also found all the evangelical counter-cult sites. And I distinctly remember my youth leaders found out that I was kind of involved with an LDS guy on the internet, and they were very worried about me. And I distinctly remember my aunt gave me "Is the Mormon My Brother" by James White for my 17th birthday. After finding all of this critical literature, though, I remember I thought I knew everything about Mormonism, and I thought, this stuff is crazy, man. I mean, only crazy people would believe these things. And I became very condescending, though, and I had decided, they must be dumb if they believe this stuff. So I just became kind of a miniature anti-Mormon, I guess. And something really changed inside me when all this happened, though, because I had been this really kind, joyful 16-year-old going to a church that I absolutely adored, only Christian in my family. And after I started reading all this literature, and I just didn't really mean to Mormons. I don't know how to explain it. I remember I looked up the temple ceremony, and I looked up the transcript, and I would go into chat rooms, and I would, like, fire off a line from the temple ceremony just to piss people off. And I did it just because I knew it would hurt them. Now, since I've been even though I'm a Christian, though, the entire time I'm telling myself I'm witnessing to Mormons, and I'm speaking the truth in love to them, as they like to say. But I really wasn't. I was just being a jerk. So something else began happening at this time, though. I started running into LDS apologists, and I would have to say that the quality of a lot of the evangelical arguments I was using against Mormonism were not very good, and I found this out the hard way. This was about the same time that Paul Owen and Carl Mosher published their paper, Mormon Apologetics, Scholarship and Evangelical Neglect, Losing the Battle and Not Knowing It. So I was very combative. I liked going on to discussion boards. I liked arguing with people. And I would frequent these discussion boards and get into arguments with LDS apologists, and they would just school me because the evangelical countercult literature was so bad. And they were so used to it. They knew all the stuff to say. So I found myself with two problems. Not only was I a jerk, I was a stupid jerk. I remember feeling totally lost because I was an evangelical Christian. This is how all the evangelical Christians, not necessarily they were all behaving as bad as me, but they were all, you know, all there was countercult literature and how widely divided. There wasn't a third path. Greg Johnson had not founded Standing Together Ministries yet. So I finally just decided that it wasn't right the way I was behaving towards Mormons, and I didn't really care if the entire evangelical Christian world was going to do the countercult thing. I decided I was going to try something different. And for me, trying something different was going to Brigham Young University and getting my undergraduate degree there. So I kind of had this huge attitude change towards Mormons, repented of countercult literature, I guess you could say. And I enrolled at Brigham Young University for my undergrad. I worked on my degree in classics with a minor in Hebrew. I've had a lot of pretty famous Mormon scholars as teachers. And eventually I wound up getting married to a Mormon, which was not the plan B I was going to try. That wasn't what I meant when I said I was going to try something different. But that's where I am now. I'm married to a Mormon. I consider myself a longtime Mormon watcher. I did a year of early morning seminary in high school. I did some institute after high school, did the entire religion core at BYU. As a student at BYU, I worked for the BYU religion department doing New Testament research. I also worked for L. Tom Perry Special Collections for the curator of 20th and 21st century collections. And I attend the church with my husband once a month. I have visiting teachers. My daughter goes to the LDS church twice a month. And I really like discussing LDS interfaith marriage, Mormon history, interfaith dialogue, and Mormon feminist issues. So that's where I am today.
You know, all the time I was at BYU, I only met two groups of people who were non-members. They were either athletes or Muslims. Now, you're obviously neither one of those. I mean, how was that being a full-on non-believer, non-member, not on sporting scholarship at BYU? I just can't even fathom what that experience is like.
I thought it was fun. It's funny that you mentioned that because the few evangelical friends that I had, they were either on the dance team, ironically, and they were Baptists, or they were, I'm sorry, Baptists don't dance, just in case they're or they were athletes. So yeah, I was very aware of that dynamic and that most of the non-members were there. There was one woman who was there who, her LDS relatives had basically made it sound like a good Christian school and just like any other Protestant college. And boy, was she mad when she got out there and realized what it was. But it was very odd. I think that people are always amazed. They would ask me, what are you doing here? And I was like, I feel like God wants me here. They were just like, wow, so when are you getting baptized? You know? But I found that people were always, you know, there's not a lot of religious diversity there, obviously, you know, 98.6% Mormon. So people were always very eager to hear what I had to say. And all I had to really do was be willing to speak up in class. And it was kind of a treat, I think, for teachers to have me in class and have somebody who would speak out in class. I remember the very first semester I was there, I won the freshman writing contest, the honors writing contest. I got to read it to an assembly of people, my essay on evangelical Christianity. And eventually, after I'd been there for a couple of years, I remember the Daily Universe. I had a class with a woman who wrote for the Daily Universe, a young student who wrote for the Daily Universe, which is the school newspaper. And things were really boring back then. So she wanted to do an article just about me being an evangelical at BYU. So she interviewed me, and that became a front page article because things were really that boring that the news story that there's a non-member here was the best thing they could put on the front page. But yeah, so I got a little bit of attention when I was there just for being there and being not LDS and being outspoken. I would sometimes have professors would tell other professors about me who would then say, would you come to my office? Because I would really like to meet you. That was how I met Spencer Pluman, who actually was the one who talked me into going into church history. So that was really cool. And Spencer Pluman is a church history professor there, obviously, but he's been involved in LDS evangelical interfaith dialogue. So he was a really cool guy to meet.
Well, you were probably a novelty. I mean, I really enjoyed my education at BYU. I think I got a good education, but there was a definite lack of diversity and opinion at that place. And I'm sure that tires the professors as much as it does the students. So I'm sure you were just a joy to have in their classes.
I think I scared them a little sometimes, but yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I remember there's this verse in the Book of Mormon, you know, I can't remember it now, but the words are, and I said unto him, I know not. Like, I remember I was taking a test one time. I couldn't remember the answer. So I wrote down the reference to that verse, and the teacher gave me credit on the question just for quoting the Book of Mormon on the test. I'm sure all the people who are Mormons at BYU are really annoyed to hear that. But yeah, I don't know. It was a lot of fun for me being a non-member who was so interested in Mormonism and having people actually just turn to me and say, hey, what do you think of this, Jack? Or am I being fair to the Protestant system or things like that? I had a lot of fun there.
Now, when I was there, they had a special section of the Book of Mormon for non-members. Do they still do that?
They don't anymore, but they did when I was there. And gosh, I shouldn't really put it down, but all the athletes were in it. And I feel so bad because, you know, I was the kind of person who liked to defend people from stereotypes. And I go to this non-LDS Book of Mormon class, and it's like high school all over again. All the athletes are like, oh, let's copy off the smart girl's paper. It was so annoying. But the real Book of Mormon classes were so hard. They had you doing so much memorization. I guess they expected that you knew this stuff, having done seminary your entire life. But I didn't know this stuff. So I took Honors Book of Mormon my second semester there, and it was like the hardest A I ever earned. I had to do so much ridiculous memorization and remembering all these little details from the Book of Mormon that I was never going to use. And the first class I actually took there was Pearl of Great Price, because I remember I was a cocky bastard who thought I knew everything about Mormonism, even though I just got there. So I took Pearl of Great Price my very first semester there, and I quickly learned that I do not know everything about Mormonism.
Now, when I was there, the underground word was you never take honors religion classes. And there was also passed around which of the Book of Mormon professors were easy and which were hard. You apparently weren't plugged into that circuit.
No, they didn't let me into the loop.
Well, now, how much of that sort of Mormon culture, now, Chris, I know you never went to BYU, but how much of that sort of Mormon stuff bleeds over into the Claremont program? Is there an in-group, out-group, or are most people just sort of more used to the normal college experience?
I think that it's probably a lot more liberal than you would get at BYU. I mean, you have your true blue Mormons, but you also have a lot of people who are open to thinking about things in very unorthodox ways. So I fit right in here. I don't feel like I'm part of an out group, really.
Well, that's one of the questions I had written to ask you guys. You obviously both understand Mormon theology and understand Mormon culture very well. Are there parts that sometimes leave you scratching your head? Would you even know? Or maybe to put it another way, are there parts that you feel like you just can't fully connect with, not having experienced?
Well, the problem for me is that I've gotten so much of it. I've gotten about as much of it as I can without having joined the church, being married to the Latter-day Saint. Before I was married to Latter-day Saint, maybe there were things that I didn't feel like I get. I mean, like, I don't get garments. I don't think I could ever do the whole wearing garments thing. I don't get the whole wearing your bra over your garments thing. Those are things I don't feel like I could ever do. And obviously, I've never been able to participate in them. But there's not a lot of Mormon culture that I haven't gotten because I'm married to a Mormon, and as part of my marriage to a Mormon, I don't drink coffee, I don't drink tea, I don't drink alcohol. We don't have any of those things in our household. I do wear tank tops all the time, and my husband loves it. And so I guess I don't dress like a Mormon. But yeah, there isn't a lot of Mormon culture that I haven't experienced as for myself. Maybe Chris has a different answer for you. I don't know.
You know, I feel like growing up Pentecostal was weird enough that I can't really blame the Mormons for being a little weird.
Yeah, and to me, you know, it's not so much weird. It's just different. You know, I attend the Unitarian Church, and you know, they're as pretty milquetoast on doctrine as you can get, but they have their own brand of weirdness, and I assume every religion does. You know, their own quirky little things they do. So,
oh yes, we do.
So you know, to me, it's always been, well, you know, it's just one or this one over here, which is one of the reasons I've never understood those from the outside who like to make fun of the LDS culture for its strange things. You know, here's a classic example. A lot of people make fun of the Mormon Church for their culinary habits, but if you listen to like a Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor, where there's a bunch of Scandinavians up in the Northeast, they do a lot of the same things. They do a lot of the Jell-O and all that sort of stuff. So I wonder how much of that is like a Mormon thing or just a Scandinavian thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I rib my Mormon friends for their weirdness, but I'm an equal opportunity ribber, so I try not to make fun of them for anything that I wouldn't make fun of myself for.
Okay.
I think it just takes a little perspective sometimes, because when I first started studying it, when I took the missionary discussions, no joke, they told me that Cain was Bigfoot.
Well, he is.
Oh, really? But I was like, oh my gosh, you guys are crazy. How can you believe this stuff? Which is, by the way, just so that we're clear, it's apparently a folk doctrine, not something that all Mormons believe or anything. I had some crazy missionaries, but I remember there's this little cartoon that goes around the internet that I think atheists like to spread a lot. It says Christianity, and it says something like the belief that a cosmic Jewish zombie, blah, 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 describes Christianity in these really bizarre terms. If you'll telepathically tell him that he's your master, he'll save you, remove an evil force from your soul. It just kind of satirizes what Christianity in general is. And, you know, it's crass and rude, but it kind of has a point that for me to sit there and say, oh my gosh, all this Mormon stuff is so weird. When I'm an evangelical Christian, I think we have plenty of stuff that would be weird to somebody who had never heard of Christianity, but since Christianity is so thoroughly embedded in our culture, everybody's heard of this stuff, so it doesn't come off as weird to them.
Yeah, I've heard several times Jan Shipps gives a great answer to that. You know, she gets asked all the time as sort of the outsider spokesman for you sort of folks, and she gets asked all the time, you know, well, how do you stomach all that weird stuff? And she says basically the same thing. If you look at Christianity from a sort of abstract point of view, then it's really just sort of as weird. You know, we all have sort of funny things we believe about this, that, and the other, and it's just what's familiar to us and what's not.
I think the weird stuff makes religion fun. I'll thank people not to take the fun out of my religion.
I love science fiction, and I think it's the same mentality that draws me to religion. It's the weirdness that I find so fascinating and exciting.
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, you know, I still consider myself a cultural Mormon, and a lot of the things that were the most meaningful to me as a child growing up, or that defined the culture and the people and that was unifying, are a lot of the things that some of the apologists and even some of the brethren these days really like to play down. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. to try to make the message as, you know, sound bite-ish, so it plays to the whole world, they sort of take out the charm and the guts of Mormonism.
I totally agree. In fact, there was a time when I was thinking about joining the church, and I mean, this was after I had heard about all the sort of wild and woolly stuff, Joseph Smith's use of a seer stone, and I mean, the sociologists like to talk about optimal tension with the culture. You can't be too weird, but you have to be somewhat weird, or else there's not enough to sort of draw people in and keep them committed. And I think the Mormonism does a pretty good job of maintaining that optimal tension. And I think that if you give up too much of that weirdness, then your religion is going to lose a lot of its appeal.
All right. I just wanted to introduce, coming into the discussion, we have our old friend, George. George, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Sorry it took me a little bit longer to get in tonight, but I'm glad I can be here.
Now, as those of you who have been listening for a while know that George is a member of the church, but one of the reasons I asked him to play with us tonight is, George, you've been actually attending with some evangelicals around your neighborhood, haven't you?
I do. I probably once or twice a month, I'm over for service and worship with my folks at one or two different churches. I'm heavily involved with the evangelical community. I'm on the board of directors for a group called Christian Youth Theater. So my interaction with evangelical Christian from probably 10 to 15 different churches here in my city is pretty intense and many times a week. In fact, there's a birthday party going on in my family room tonight where they had a very non-Mormon prayer over their food before they started because most of them are evangelicals and my Mormon daughter.
Okay, welcome.
Thanks.
So as outsiders, what do you think, to you personally, are the most compelling or most interesting of the Mormon teachings?
Well, for me, one of the things that was most fascinating to me when I first started studying them was that they still believed that there were prophets in the world today. I mean, I'm a big fan of kind of the crazy stuff in the Bible, you know, bears mauling people, getting water from rock, fire from heaven. I think that stuff is awesome. So that there were people who believed that could still happen today, I was so intrigued. I was just stoked about that. And I guess I was never one of those evangelicals who turned my Bible to Revelation 22:18 and said, hey, you guys are adding on to the Bible. I was always okay with the idea of modern day revelation and an open canon. That's one of them for me. Chris, you got one?
That's actually a really good one because having been raised Pentecostal, you know, we did all of the revelation and prophecies and tongues and everything. So to read in Mormon history and find out that the Mormons were doing this 70 years before the Pentecostal started and was really kind of disturbing for me as a Pentecostal, because, you know, I was raised to believe that the gifts were restored in 1900. And so, it bothered me a bit that Joseph Smith had beat us to it. And also the idea that he's adding that these revelations have the authority of the Bible. I mean, Pentecostals kind of limit themselves and say, yes, we still do revelation, but it can't be on a par with the Bible. And it's kind of hard to justify that. And I thought the Mormons had a really good point with that.
You know, that's interesting because when I've read a little bit about especially the beginning of Pentecostalism and the early days of the church, they're very, very similar in the way that people sort of experience the services, at least in my mind.
Absolutely.
I probably should have said earlier that I did go to Assemblies of God while I was at college in BYU. So I was a member of a Pentecostal denomination for a couple of years. So I do get what Chris is saying about tongues and the gifts and everything. I also thought that what was very intriguing to me is I think that LDS thought is very deep and varied and robust for what amounts to a church that is the size of a single Protestant denomination. I mean, in Protestant Christianity, when you start to develop different ideas that disagree with the denomination, you branch out, you switch to a different church if your ideas get too radical for your denomination. But in Mormonism, you can't really branch out that the idea of priesthood authority keeps people in the denomination until they kind of, you know, the shelf breaks, they leave, whatever. But they develop different ideas within the denomination and they stay. So you have a very wide spectrum of thought within what amounts to one denomination when comparing it to Protestants. And I think that surprises Protestants a lot to encounter so much variety. And, you know, we complain that you can't nail down Mormon doctrine. It's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. But I think that's part of the problem that we get this huge spectrum of thought. It's basically its own religious tradition, but it's the size of one denomination. And that surprises us. But the intellectual depth and variety was great to me. I encountered a lot of LDS philosophers and thinkers who, it was very intriguing to me to watch how they would try to solve the problems with Mormonism. 200 years after Christ's death, the Council of Nicaea hadn't met yet. Christian theology was still crystallizing. And I think of Mormonism like that. It's still a religion that's in its infancy. and it's still developing. And I'm very excited to be in dialogue with it and to be here watching it develop. The other thing I love about Mormonism is that I think that men look best when they're wearing nice suits, and Mormonism has lots of that going on. So those are the things I love about Mormonism.
Well, when you were at BYU, you probably had a great time because that's where you see the most of it, right?
Oh, yeah. Somebody needs to check and make sure those guys are wearing their garments.
Well, you know, you bring up a great point with the depth of theology. I think that that's something that's not understood either inside or outside the church. And part of the problem, I blame it, the, you know, correlation phase of the church, because you read these manuals that come out today, you know, the teachings of Brigham Young, the teachings of John Taylor, and what you're really reading in there is the teachings of, you know, Gordon Hinckley through the voice of Brigham Young. And unfortunately, that they've glossed over this rich, rich heritage of these ideas that developed and passed, you know, say from Joseph Fielding Smith to his son to Bruce R. McConkie, and they have these long heritage, and there's these strings and threads of these ideas that go through there, but nobody understands that, or the people who do are there. There's very few of them
trying to make it to conform to modern day thinking on these issues,
right? Which probably lends to much of the confusion outside the, well, both inside and outside, because you know, most Mormons don't understand it, and you know, you take people like Ed Decker, who would take things very much out of context from 150 years ago and try to present them as if they were ideas from today, and he would present a church that no one understood.
When I was an evangelical, I started studying the early church fathers to find out what the, you know, doctrine of the original church believed, and I was very surprised to learn that a lot of what Mormons believe was reflected there, the idea of three heavens, deification. Very surprisingly, has been taught throughout the entire course of the church, and I think that's one of the things that evangelicals see as, you know, the most offensive aspect of Mormonism, which on that point I think that they're much more out of harmony with historic Christianity than Mormonism. And then the other one is the idea of post-mortem evangelization, that people can be baptized after death. I think, you know, and if you read the New Testament straightforwardly, you read that verse in Corinthians about baptism for the dead straightforwardly, I think you have to arrive at something like the LDS view. And the First Peter verse also about, you know, Jesus going and preaching to the spirits in prison, I think that does lead to something like the LDS view. So I find that pretty compelling also.
Bridget, you mentioned early on, you were talking about a lot of the counter-cult literature and how awful it is in terms of accuracy. Then that's been something that I've noticed. It seems like virtually anything that I've come across, or most of it that I've come across that comes from an outside religious view, tends to be just awful when it comes to both the attitude it takes to the church and the liberties it plays with factual information. Why do you suppose that our friends in the outside churches tend to have such trouble getting it right?
Well, I should qualify what I said earlier by clarifying that not all countercult ministries are created equal. I'm generally not a fan of the approach at all, but I do need to say, or else I'm going to get in trouble later on, that some of them are better than others, and some of them do try harder than others to be more accurate or to respond to critics or to interact with criticisms of their work. So they aren't all some guy in a basement ranting about Mormonism while he posts articles on his web, you know, on his website.
Right.
But why is it so inaccurate? Partially because there's an agenda there. The agenda is to keep people from joining Mormonism. And I think that some people, not naming names, but I think that some people feel that the ends justify the means. And if it scares people away from Mormonism, then they don't really have to be accurate. The other part is that Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, especially, they both claim to be the same thing. Evangelical Christianity claims to be a return to early Christianity. Mormonism claims to be a restoration of early Christianity. I've often felt that the reaction that Mormons and evangelicals give each other is a lot like when two girls go to the prom and they notice they're wearing the same dress. You know, they want to rip it off of each other. I've had this experience. You want to rip it off the other girl. But I think it's a little bit like that.
Did it actually happen?
Oh, I didn't rip it off.
Okay, you didn't rip it off. Okay.
In my mind, I did.
Just wanted to check and see if that was one of those dances at BYU. That would have been very interesting.
Oh, no. But I think that accounts for some of why it's bad. The other part is, though, that a lot of people who run counseling cult ministries, I think you have to cut them a little bit of a break because they're not scholars. I mean, they're not people who can go toe-to-toe with the people at BYU who have degrees from Ivy League colleges and everything. Most of them, they have maybe a bachelor's degree or something. A lot of people decide to get involved when they don't have any postgraduate or post-college, post-high school education. So part of it is just that, shoddy research and just not being very good at making really scholarly arguments. They just have to work with what they have. So that's part of it. I think that another thing to realize, though, is that the big guns in evangelical thought are not trained on Mormonism. I mean, it is really hard to get the big evangelical thinkers and philosophers to come and pay attention to Mormonism. They think it's just kind of this kooky anti-intellectual group that no one really takes seriously, and they've got bigger fish to fry. And a lot of Mormons are not publishing their criticisms and their work in peer-reviewed journals and places where the evangelical world is likely to see it. Evangelical scholars are not reading Farm's Review of Books or Journal of Book of Mormon Studies. So I think that a lot of evangelicals just remain unaware of what Mormons are saying about them. So that's why they don't get involved.
Well, that's interesting, because that's the next question I was going to ask. I think there is an inside tendency for Mormons to feel particularly picked on. And my question was going to be, well, do evangelicals or other Christian groups focus on Mormons that much? You know, for example, a lot of LDS people talk about how in their youth programs in other churches, they all get this sort of indoctrination against Mormons, where they get shown the God makers, whatever. And it sounds like for either of you, you didn't really have that sort of experience where you encountered Mormonism before you met one. A Mormon.
Well, I think that particularly in Utah, you get more of that than you would outside of the state, because it's so evident everywhere in the state. California, we didn't really talk about Mormons much at all, and when we did, it was just passing comments. But there's definitely ignorance in evangelical churches that I've encountered about Mormonism, but it just doesn't come up that often.
Well, I think it might be fed by missionary lore. Missionaries oftentimes swap stories, and they think the world is out to get them, that, all the congregations out there are doing anti-missionary training and getting ready for them that way.
Uh-huh.
I know here in our area there's some examples, and I haven't sat in on one, but I know there's some examples in some of the larger evangelical churches about doing either in their youth ministry or having a specialized class on basically raising the awareness. And they always use the story that says, if you're going to pass around and have a currency, you need to be able to understand that whether the currency is counterfeit or real. And so they'll have these, are the other religions counterfeit or real? And so it's been presented to me like that two or three times. And so they are getting at least a baseline of understanding here, and I don't live anywhere near the Mormon corridor, so I think it does happen outside of the area to some extent.
Well, I personally have not attended a church that had like a class on Mormonism or a session on Mormonism or anything. I mean, my experience as an evangelical is that there's some generally hostile feelings, but most evangelicals are in the don't know, don't care department. I remember a couple of months ago, Richard Ossling published an article in Christianity Today that was, I think it was close to 50% of Christians said that, yes, they think Mormons are Christians. And depending on how you want to take that statistic, I don't know who exactly was included in the survey on Christians, but the countercult people were alarmed because 50% of Christians said that Mormons are Christians, and the Mormons were alarmed because 50% of people said that Mormons were Christians. But I don't feel like there's a ton of focus of it on it in evangelical Christianity. But the other thing that I think is so important to realize when people make that complaint is that it's not like Mormons have never taken shots at the rest of the Christian world before. I mean, the current Gospel Principles Manual has a line in chapter 16 about how pagan beliefs corrupted the Christian concept of God. The concept of God for those called Christians, it implies that they're not Christians. And now I think it calls it false Christianity. And it says that this includes Christians who believe, really wish that I'd brought the quote before I talked about this, but this includes Christians who believe that God is formless and invisible, something like that. And it's in the current 2009 Gospel Principles Manual. And I was talking with a friend about it, and he basically said, yeah, the manual was written in 1978 and it really hasn't been revised very well. And I can believe that, but that's one example that just goes to show that it's not like the church has never taken shots at other Christians. The 1990 temple ceremony is an example. I did a paper for one of my classes last semester where I went through history and tracked some of the cases where the church had said not so nice things about other Christians. And I mean, it has to be understood that in the 19th century, it was very common for Protestants to say very unkind things about other Protestants. There was nothing unusual about that. But I think it's just important to realize that it hasn't been an entirely one-way thing. Mormons have taken shots at other Christians before, and occasionally they still do.
You know, that's true. I grew up in the 70s, and I need to find this. We had a manual where we learned about like Martin Luther and some of those guys. So we did have which is more than they do now. But I grew up with a very installed hostility towards, say, Catholicism. And of course, in the 19th century, early 20th century, the Mormons, and following a lot of American culture in general, very anti-Catholic. So you're right. That road does go both directions.
Let me tell you one story that happened to me last year, though. When I moved out here to Chicago and I was looking for a church, I was calling around. I was being very careful about my church hunt because I can get a hostile reaction to this whole having a Mormon husband thing. And I need to take him to a church where they're not going to do any of these classes on Mormonism or whatever. And I called this one pastor and I was talking with her about her congregation. It sounded okay so far. And I brought up that my husband was LDS. And it was like I was talking to a totally different person. And she started going off to me about how the temple ceremony is satanic and I can't remember all the things. She was very condescending and rude to me, kept cutting me off when I tried to explain my situation. And you understand that he believes in a different Jesus and he believes Jesus is the brother of Satan. It was just like she was reading the counter-cult ministry script. And later on, she sent me an email telling me, don't even come to my church.
Wow.
So hostility to Mormons in the evangelical Christian world definitely does happen. I don't want to deny or downplay that. I just don't think it happens as often as some Latter-day Saints would have you to believe, and I don't think it's as systematic as some Latter-day Saints would say.
Yeah, our family had a similar experience probably 10 years ago. We were going to go check out the local Christian church to Christian school to send our kids to. We wanted to pull them out of private, and we had a nice conversation with the teacher and was meeting with the principal, and it finally got to the point where she flat out asked us, you know, what church we would attend to, and we told her we were LDS, and she said, oh, your kids won't be welcome here. And it was sort of, you know, this was for kindergartners, you know, kindergarten, first, second grade. And she says, well, we'll be actively teaching that their church is satanic and wrong and evil. You know, do you really want to put your kids through that? And we were just stunned. And they were just so, needless to say, we didn't sign the kids up there, but that was an interesting one for us.
Yeah, it does happen. So I don't want somebody to say later on that I said that it doesn't. It definitely does, and I'm always so sad to hear when it does.
Okay, speaking of criticism, we've had sort of a love fest for the last few minutes. You two are both labeled critics online, or at least I've seen you labeled that way before. So as an outsider observing, what do you think are the, the weak spots of Mormonism? What do you think are the areas where Mormonism is not so strong? Chris, why don't you start?
I think that Mormons are very ingrown. They're a very ingrown group, so they tend to be overwhelmingly Republican. They tend to have a bit of a persecution complex. They demonize people who leave the group, apostates, Mormons. Their thought also, we mentioned BYU earlier and how it's 98.6% Mormon. I mean, they don't really branch out and interact with other groups a lot, at least in Utah. And I think that's probably, those aspects are one of the biggest problems. And I also think that the church has routinized the fact that it's all top-down hierarchy. Means that the leaders control a lot of the sorts of services or worship that happen at the basic church level. And so in, you know, Africa or South America, where they have different styles of worship, those kinds of stylistic differences tend to get suppressed and they get forced into this sort of American model of what Mormonism is. And I think that that could be very damaging for the church and its growth overseas.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was just watching last week. My wife and I were watching a PBS series called, I think it's Wild China, where they they go in the back villages. And there was this village that had been stuck on this steep hillside and had been there for 1,000 years. And I just the thought came to my mind of them learning the primary songs, because that's what the church exports, right? It's you know, they can't adapt it. It's got to be the, you know, they sit in a chapel and then they eat the white bread for the sacrament and that sort of stuff. So I think that's a good point.
Yeah, well, there was an article in the Ensign years ago that talked about a Pentecostal congregation in Africa that had converted wholesale to Mormonism, and it made the comment that they still use drums and guitars, but that's just something they'll have to unlearn over time. And I thought, why would they have to unlearn that? Why is that something that they can't just do and be good Mormons and still worship in their own way?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that would have definitely been on my list too, but I think the LDS churches, I think the Mormons are huge purveyors of religious cultural imperialism. You know how the saying goes, the church is the same wherever you go. And that's not necessarily a good thing. I think that Chris has talked about this somewhere else. I remember him posting some quotes about this, but I remember my LDS friends have given me quotes. They're very, very proud of the fact that they've always had integrated congregations. They've never had segregated wards for Black people, like a lot of other churches did. But I remember Chris posted some quotes about how the truth is that minority groups, they want the door for integration to be open, but their leaders in other denominations have said that they like having their own separate congregations and bodies of their own to worship, because when they blend in with white people and they integrate, they find that their culture and their style of worship gets eradicated. And that's exactly what's happened with the LDS church and other countries. And I think that's going to be a huge stumbling block for the church as it tries to expand across the globe.
Well, yeah. And if you consider where the church is successful, it's generally in places where they still admire American culture, and places where they turn against American culture, like Europe these days, then it doesn't do so well.
Yep, that's definitely part of it. Something I would have put at the top of my list is that I think that the church is kind of bad at accepting constructive criticism. It doesn't matter what me and Chris say here, somebody would probably find it anti-Mormon or too critical, no matter how gentle and friendly we're trying to be about it. But there have been statements from leaders specifically discouraging Mormons from openly criticizing their leaders. I think it was Dallin Oaks. He said something like, it's wrong to criticize leaders of the church, even if the criticism is true.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's, you see, we're, Chris and I both come from a Protestant background, and our entire religion got started by a guy who went and nailed 95 complaints out in the open where people could see them. So it's very, very strange, I think, for us. I'm not trying to speak for Chris, but it's very, very strange for me to be interacting with a religion where we're not supposed to criticize the leaders. I criticize evangelical leaders all the time. They do something wrong, I'm going to complain about it. And I think that's a good thing for us. And it helps keep us stronger and kind of weed out our errors. And we keep each other honest. So.
Well, and just from a strictly sociological standpoint, you kind of lose the energy of your religion for a while if you don't have the ability for people to speak from grassroots and call for renewal of the religion, for reformation of the religion, and even to split into new sects. I mean, it's been argued that that's the reason that Pentecostalism is gaining 23 million members a year, because every time one of the Pentecostal denominations starts to lose the fire of the Holy Spirit, they just split off and start a new church. And so you get this incredible proliferation of churches, and they all manage somehow to sort of keep this continual renewal and the energy going. Whereas Mormonism, you know, I mentioned earlier that I thought it was really cool that they had been speaking tongues back in 1830, but who speaks in tongues today and who prophesies today? Those things just don't happen so much anymore. So
I would also say that there isn't very good freedom of practice within the religion. They tell you what type of clothes are okay to wear, how many earrings you can have, what types of underwear to wear, whether or not it's okay to have a beard, how long your hair can be, what kinds of drinks you can have, tattoos. And that's a long list of requirements for religion. I mean, if you go and look at the other Christian religions and denominations in America, I'm not sure that anybody else has a list that long of that, other than maybe some like Southern fundamentalists, but I don't even think their list would be that long. And that's a lot of requirements for religion, especially a denomination the size of the LDS Church. And it's often, I sometimes lament that this is a religion that builds its entire theology around the concept of free agency and gives you precious little of it in practice.
Here's the interesting thing about free agency, because a lot of times what you hear in the church is that we do have the free agency to do that, but make our choices. But any church that would be led by God and would be a place that it would be worth to get back to Him is going to be hard to live. So that's kind of the justification that you hear for the rules. What do the two of you think about that as a reasoning? Because it does make sense in some ways.
I think you're right. And sociologists have shown that religions that make demands are the ones that are successful. A religion has to make demands. But I think there are reasonable demands, and then there are demands that just don't make a lot of sense. And there are neutral demands and demands that can be actually oppressive and keep people's cultures suppressed. And so I don't want to get down on, you know, the idea of moral demands. I think that's fine. But I think the church should pick and choose its battles a little more carefully.
Well, and for me, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think right now, the church is sort of feeding on itself. The demands are eating up the culture that had been developed over 120, 130 years, where a lot of the cultural elements say things like the bazaars they used to have in the wards, or the state camps, or the road shows, or a lot of those cultural elements that were really alive and vibrant in the 50s, 60s, and 70s have been systematically weeded out by correlation. So I think the problem is the church can sometimes turn on itself in a very negative sort of way. In the interest of fiscal responsibility. I don't know what's really driving all that.
Now, I know in our stake here, we are having a multi-stake regional dance festival this year. They did road shows this last year. So I think there's a sense of going back to that, but it is sure a message-ridden thing, that the big predominant message around all of these is, you know, the kids have to learn to strengthen their testimony through dance and things like that. So it is a little bit different than it was in the old days, where you dance just to have a dance.
As the sole atheist on the board here, I have to ask you guys the hard question. I'll call it the Tanner question. So the Tanners have been criticized, I think, fairly, because they have oftentimes applied to the church this high order of criticism of intellectual and, systematic justification. They hold the church to very high standards when it comes to logic and reason and its history, and yet they maintain their own belief in Christianity and don't apply those same sort of things to themselves. As you guys look at the church critically, how has that affected your own belief and your own religious views?
Well, for me, studying, I mean, that was really the key in me liberalizing. I found myself making arguments against Mormonism, and then those arguments were deflected back onto me, and you know, the people who were deflecting them wanted me to say, well, you're right, if this argument applies to my religion, then I should throw out the argument. But instead, I did the opposite. I accepted the argument, and it really undermined a lot of what I believed, and that's why I'm a Christian pluralist instead of an evangelical today. So, I mean, Mormonism really, for me, was the gateway to liberalizing.
I would say that for me, so far, I simply try not to make arguments which I know can be deflected back against my religion, or if they can be deflected back against my religion, then I agree that that's something my religion needs to work on and improve on. For example, I remember when I first began complaining about the status of women in the LDS church, people would be like, well, lots of evangelical churches don't treat women very well either. And I guess they wanted me to say, oh, well, it's all okay then. And my reaction to that was like, no, then I think evangelical churches can get better. So that's why I'm a member of Christians for Biblical Equality now. That's part of it. But really, I've just tried to, I've tried not to be too critical. I've tried not to choose arguments that can be deflected back on Christianity. And I've tried to study out the hard issues in my own religion and keep myself to the standards that I'm applying to Mormonism. So I have cautioned people to be careful about what we think we can argue as far as Mormonism goes. Sorry.
Can I ask you a little bit about that same standard statement? Because one of the things that I've had a struggle with as I've moved kind of from Mormonism into, I think, what you'd call mainstream Christianity is the use and the same standards of some of the questions that are endemic. So I will have a question about Mormonism, and you can easily find that as a question Mormon, you could go to an apologetic answer to get that, to get an answer. And most Christians would say, yeah, well, you can't use an apologist because that isn't fair. But at the same time, if I go to a Christian with what could be a really tough question, a biblical question, and say, well, what about this? And they say, well, have you read so-and-so? Have you read Science and Theology? Or, you know, one of these basically Christianity apologist book. It's trying to apply the same standard across both of them. And that's where I'm having a hard time, is if I'm not going to buy the story that I hear from Mormon apologetics, how can I buy the story that's fed to me by the Christian apologist for a different thing? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that consistency is really important. But see, I don't throw out all Mormon apologetics wholesale. I think that there's some apologists who are really bad at what they do, and some apologists who are quite good at what they do. And, you know, some of the arguments have some convincing points to make. And so I would say you just need to have a standard of what's rational and reasonable, and just apply that standard across the board and go with what is most compelling.
Chris, I have to say, I saw a tagline from you very recently. You said something to the effect of, you're not a critic of Mormonism, you're a critic of bad apologetics.
Yeah.
That was brilliant, by the way.
Thank you.
Let me then ask another question, because it's easy for the Christian to go after the Book of Mormon, but then it's just as easy for any person who's read the Bible to go after portions of the Bible and say, come on, do you really believe that? Especially major portions of the Old Testament. But as I've gotten involved with people, one of the basics of Christianity that it's the basic set of things that you have to accept is the word. And that has been taught to me to mean you have to believe all the aspects of the Bible as they're included, including, you know, the bears coming out and eating the little kids because they called the guy bald. And
that is my favorite story in the Bible, so
I
don't
know.
Knock it.
Well, the talking donkey, Lot getting his daughters pregnant because it was their idea. You know, the Tower of Babel, the splitting of the sea, all kinds of different things that have a struggle scientifically. Just like we want to go after the Book of Mormon scientifically, there's some real hard Old Testament stories to go after scientifically. How do you keep your faith in all the Old Testament stories scientifically, yet use scientific reasons to dismiss the Book of Mormon?
Well, personally, I don't use scientific reasons to dismiss the Book of Mormon. I'm actually somebody who rarely attacks the Book of Mormon. And I never attack something because I think that story is too stupid or crazy or supernatural to be true. I mean, as I see it, the story of the resurrection and the resurrection of Christ, that's one of the most amazing things in the Bible. And I don't see the other stories in the Bible as being any crazier or less rational than that. So I'm not really somebody who reads this and thinks this is too crazy and stupid to be believed. As far as using science, I'm not really somebody who goes through and argues with DNA evidence or whatever. The one thing that I do point out sometimes, though, is that the Bible is acknowledged as coming from, you know, an ancient Middle Eastern context. The Book of Mormon is totally not. I mean, the Book of Mormon has so many signs and warnings in it that it does not come from a Middle Eastern context. And it does not fit it does not fit an ancient American context. That's probably the only argument that I really use on the Book of Mormon that that can apply to the Book of Mormon that doesn't apply to the Bible. But I'm generally not somebody who really attacks the Book of Mormon a lot because I don't find it very productive to my conversations with Latter-day Saints. A lot of them are very, very attached to the Book of Mormon, and I think it causes bad blood between us if I attack the Book of Mormon. And I agree that there are a lot of arguments out there that can be turned against the Bible. Like when I first began studying the church, I remember seeing a list of contradictions in the Book of Mormon. And, you know, there's plenty of lists of contradictions in the Bible, and the same arguments that can be used for solving the Bible contradictions can be used for solving the Book of Mormon contradictions. So maybe that's a bit of a cop-out, but I guess I'm just not really somebody who goes around attacking the Book of Mormon for that reason.
And for me, George, we talked about this a little bit before you came. I'm a very liberal Christian, so I don't actually accept the full Bible as binding. For me, the heart of Christianity is the ethical and spiritual teachings of Jesus. And I accept them because they're powerful and compelling to me and because they speak to me, and not because they've been canonized by a church council or whatever.
I think that's one of the hard things, pinning down exactly what Christianity is. I think it's very easy to pin down Mormonism and say, here's at least its current day teachings, and here's what it means. Man, you could talk to 10 different Christians about their perception of whether the Bible is accurate in everything that it describes or not, and you'd probably get 13 different opinions. And it's fascinating to see this idea of being a liberal Christian, and yeah, you can do this, and then get a slightly different view from somebody else. It's a wonderful experience, but it's new. It's something that the Mormon leaving that experience and then going and wanting something to replace it just doesn't seem like it's found, at least in mainstream evangelical Christianity.
But, you know, I had an LDS friend who was thinking of leaving the church, and she had asked me about inerrancy. She was really struggling with the concept of inerrancy and the idea that the entire Bible could be inerrant. And I was talking with a professor about it because I think that inerrancy is a very hard sell for ex-Mormons. And he was like, Bridget, our message has never been we have an inerrant Bible. Don't let her get caught up on the things that are not ultimately essential. He said, our message has always been that Christ is risen, and that in believing in him, you can have eternal life, and you don't have to believe in an inerrant Bible to have that. So I would have to say that if inerrancy is bothering you that much, don't let it trip you up. I mean, I think it's important and I believe in it, but you can be a Christian and not believe in inerrancy. And I firmly believe that you can accept Jesus Christ and just be a practicing Christian if you don't believe in inerrancy. So.
Yeah, I would agree. Of the top 10 things that I think it seems to mean to be a Christian, accepting the full thing of being word is probably, you know, 10th on the list. Obviously, accepting his grace and acknowledging the Savior as your Redeemer, I think, is the number one. Acknowledging yourself as a sinner would probably be right up. You know, there's top three or four. I think it's kind of defined in Romans what the list is. So, yeah, I would agree with you.
Well, guys, it's been the hour's gone by as always it does. I think for both of you, Chris, returning, and Bridget, we're just getting to know you. There's a lot of topics that I'd sure like to plumb deeper, and we'll probably have to bring you back in the future. So once again, thanks for coming on to the podcast.
And just to reiterate that, I haven't had a chance to yet to read a lot of Chris's work. Bridget, I went through your blog work when you were at the Y, and oh my gosh, what a fascinating, fun experience that would have been to kind of just hang out with you at that point. So I'm glad you made it through it and you survived. That's wow.
Yeah. Why don't you both throw out your blogs? Chris, go ahead and throw yours out.
My blog is it's called Mild Mannered Musings. You can find it on Google, or you can type Chris Carroll Smith. That's with two R's and two L's in Carroll.blogspot.com.
And we have a link to it from our front page. And Bridget, your blog?
Well, thank you, George, for your kind words. And my blog is at www.clobberblog.com. That's Clobberblog. And it is also linked to on the Mormon Expression front page.
Yes, it is. As always, the discussion continues on the website at mormonexpression.com. You can send us an email at mail@mormonexpression.com or call us at our number 801-906-6722.